From South Dakota to Kentucky, Missouri to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it has fallen off the radar screen, but Obamacare is still in effect and problems persist. Steve Moore of the Heritage Foundation and FreedomWorks is here with 8 reasons why the program has failed. Primary elections were held in Virginia and South Carolina, with one incumbent congressman going down to defeat. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Charter schools are a big hit in Los Angeles. Reasons Eric Boehm and Lisa Snell take a look at why so many parents are choosing this option for their children. And President Trump held an historic summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on how this ushers in a new era of diplomacy. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, fell one vote short in the U.S. Senate. Since then, Congress has not tried to again address the issue, but major problems persist. Here to talk about them is Steve Moore. Steve is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and an economic consultant with FreedomWorks. He formerly advised the Trump presidential campaign on economic issues. Steve, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Steve, we haven't heard a lot about Obamacare and about health care reform in the last few weeks. There have been so many other issues that have taken center stage, but it's still out there. Are there still ongoing efforts to reform or repeal Obamacare?
Yeah, there sure are. Obamacare, by the way, is a train wreck that is just continuing to pile up cars, and it's in a death spiral where the people who sign up for the insurance are paying more and more expensive rates. In fact, for people in these new healthcare exchanges set up by Obamacare, the premiums in many states have doubled in 5 or 6 years. So that's hardly price and cost control. A lot of people cannot afford it. I say in my article that we should rename the Affordable Care Act the Unaffordable Care Act, the UCA, because it has really led to a spiraling of cost. Exactly, by the way, as we had predicted. I was at the Wall Street Journal editorial board at the time Obamacare passed, and I think we wrote an editorial almost every day about this would be a disaster for American families, and it has been.
Your article went through 8 specific points, and let's take a couple of seconds at least to talk about each of them. Let's start out, you touched upon this. Healthcare is more expensive. How much more are Americans paying because of this Unaffordable Care Act?
Well, it depends on what state you live in, but in the average state, we've seen is well better than 50% increases in the premiums over the last 5 or 6 years. And in some states, for example, in Arizona, the premiums have doubled. So you're seeing big increases in the cost of insurance. And don't forget, the number one promise that you remember this one when Barack Obama was running for president, he said, my Obamacare plan will save the average family $2,500 a year. Well, raise your hand if you're saving $2,500 a year on your health insurance. I don't think too many people are feeling that effect. We're paying a lot more, not less.
I'm not seeing too many hands go up out there. So. Now, another area, entitlement spending, it's going out of control. Recently, more people added in Virginia. Can you talk a bit about that?
The point that you just made has to do with constraining the overall cost of our health insurance system because, we keep spending more and more and more on health care, and we always haven't gotten the results that we want in terms of improved health. And one of the things that we found in the study that we did was that the share of our economy devoted to health care has gone up under Obamacare. It hasn't gone down. So again, Barack Obama famously said, we're going to bend the cost curve of healthcare down. Unfortunately, the cost curve has bent further up.
What about the cost of care itself? Are we seeing that was supposed to have brought the cost of care down? Are we still seeing prices for healthcare, not insurance, but for healthcare going up?
Well, let's not forget, the vast majority of people get their health and care through the insurance mechanism. And so what we've seen under Obamacare, by the way, is I mentioned the higher premiums. What I didn't mention is that also people have higher deductibles. Now, that means you're paying more. Think about that. It means you're paying more for health insurance that covers you for less. That's quite a deal.
So we're paying more for health insurance. We're paying more for the procedures, or our insurance companies are. We're getting less coverage. I guess.
By the way, I'm in favor of higher deductible policies. I've always been. I like medical savings accounts. You pay more out of pocket, but then the reward for that is you get lower premiums, right? You get lower monthly premiums. But under Obamacare, you get higher premiums and higher deductibles. So it's a lose-lose proposition.
But we are getting more choices, right?
Well, that's the problem, too. I mean, that's another problem. I found that there were, I think, almost half of counties now in America, you only have one or two insurance companies left because so many have dropped out of the market. So you actually have less competition and less choices. And one of the points I make is, look, in every industry where you have falling prices or stable prices, you have competition. Competition was what keeps prices down, whether it's buying a pizza or buying an electrical appliance or computer software. The more competition, the better. And yet we've eliminated in so many areas competition. And you know, without competition, you get prices, you usually get lousy service and higher prices.
The whole Obamacare, the whole health care debate, Steve, go back to the very beginning. And it started out over the fact that we had so many millions of Americans who were uninsured. So with all these increases in prices, less choices, all the things you've mentioned, surely at this point we've provided coverage for everybody as was intended.
Well, no, and the reason for that is we don't know exactly how many people don't have insurance, but it's still about 25 to 30 million people. Now, it's come down a lot since Obama took office. But by the way, the primary reason and method that Obama used to reduce the people without health insurance is he massively expanded the Medicaid program, which is a welfare program for low-income people who couldn't afford health care. And so we estimate 80 to 90% of the people who got coverage didn't get it through the Obamacare insurance system. They went to sign up for a welfare program. And by the way, Medicaid doesn't provide you very good coverage either. So it hasn't fulfilled its promises. In fact, the Obamacare, what they call the exchanges, many of them have had 80% reductions in the number of people who've enrolled for those programs over what was expected. And now that people aren't forced, we got rid of the individual penalty with the mandate penalty, the tax, if you didn't buy the insurance. And now that that penalty has been eliminated, thank goodness, because that mainly hit lower income people, now you're going to see even more and more people dropping out of Obamacare.
You, Steve, of course, were an advisor to President Trump's campaign, and the president has made reducing regulation, including health care, a centerpiece of his administration. What steps has the administration been able to take without congressional approval just by eliminating regulations? Have they made any progress on that front?
Not as much as we'd like, because so many of these regulations are embedded into the Obamacare law. So one of the most important things would be allow people. Look, my own feeling, and I think this is where most members of Congress, and I think the president is here too, if you like Obamacare, you should be able to keep it. Let's not, you know, you don't have to get rid of it. The main thing we need to do is give people much more options. And so if you want Obamacare, you can stay in that system. It's going to be expensive because it's expensive care. Or you could provide medical savings accounts. You could provide other types of vehicles. Short-term health insurance for people. We can certainly provide people with pre-existing conditions coverage, but that doesn't mean you have to screw up the whole entire healthcare system to pay for that. And so what I believe is in more competition, more types of plans, let Americans pick and choose what they want. And under Obamacare, if you don't purchase a plan that complies with all the Obamacare regulations, coverage for contraceptives, mental health, eye care, dental care, all that stuff. A lot of people can't afford those gold-plated plans. If you don't get a gold-plated plan, you can't get any plan at all. So I say open it up for more competition, and that will lower cost.
We have been talking with Steve Moore, who is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and an economic consultant at FreedomWorks. Formerly was a senior economics consultant to the Trump presidential campaign. We've been talking about Obamacare. Still much work to be done on that front. Steve, if we have folks who would like to read the article you referenced earlier and or your other writings, where can they go to get that information?
Well, it's called 7 Reasons to Still Hate Obamacare, and it's in. You can either go to the Washington Times website where I write a weekly column or heritage.org, and you can pick it up there.
Steve Moore of the Heritage Foundation and FreedomWorks. Steve, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, carefully tracking all the state-by-state primaries that are taking place across the country. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We did have another round of primaries this past Tuesday, so let's start out in the Old Dominion in Virginia. There is a U.S. Senate seat up, Tim Kaine's, to be specific. What happened in the Republican primary?
Just as an initial backdrop, Virginia is one of the tougher seats for Republicans to pick up. You know, there are like 10 Trump states that the Republicans are trying to target, try and pick up. Conservative states like Missouri and Indiana and North Dakota and Montana, and all the way down at 10 or 11 is Virginia. So already this is kind of a long shot. But there were a lot of people watching this GOP primary to see if a viable candidate could win it to take on Tim Kaine, who your listeners may remember was Hillary Clinton's VP running mate. So the primary was last week. It was a three-way contest between Corey Stewart, who was a very combative fringe candidate. Then there was Nick Freitas, who is a delegate in the Virginia House. Very free market, very much like Rand Paul. He was endorsed by Rand Paul, endorsed by Mike Lee. Very pro-free market guy. And then E.W. Jackson, who ran for lieutenant governor a few years ago, but hasn't really done much since. It was kind of the hope that Nick Freitas would get the nomination, because even though he's very free market and very solid on economic issues, he's also mildly supported by the establishment. They don't see him as a huge threat. But Corey Stewart really knew how to fire up the base. He really knew how to flamethrow in the primary. And he ended up winning it by, I think, just 1 or 2 percentage points. So he's now the nominee to run against Kaine in November.
Anything of interest in the congressional district races in Virginia?
That's the thing, is that there are a handful of competitive races in Virginia. There's one in my district, Virginia's 10th, where Republican Barbara Comstock, a moderate, which is a very favorable term for her, she's in a competitive race. Virginia's 5th district, which is basically one-third of Virginia. It's the size of New Jersey, actually, the district. That's competitive. And then the Virginia Beach area, Virginia 2, that's competitive. And the reason why Corey Stewart's victory last week in the Senate race was a big deal is that it's now believed that his nomination for the Senate race will drag the down-ballot races, so people won't show up to vote on those important House races when they otherwise would have if Nick Freitas was the nominee. So there's a concern there. I hope that we can at least save the 5th district, the one that's the size of New Jersey, because we have a very conservative Republican running there. The other two districts, the Republicans that are running for re-election are extreme moderate. So I'll be less heartbroken if those are gone.
Another state that held primaries was South Carolina. Now, a couple of interesting developments there in congressional district races. An unusual development, an incumbent Republican went down to defeat in the primary. Who was that and what happened?
Yeah, Mark Sanford. Your listeners may recognize that name. He was a former member of the House way back in the 1990s. He was a solid fiscal conservative, absolutely solid. He made a term limits pledge. He honored that pledge. Then he ran and won for governor of South Carolina. He was a governor for 8 years, very strong record. He vetoed so much egregious spending. He was an absolute champion. In fact, there were some that believed that he would one day perhaps try and pursue the White House. But, of course, his personal life got in the way. He said that he was off hiking on the Appalachian Trail when, in fact, he was having an affair, and that kind of forced him to resign in scandal. But he made a political comeback, I think less than 2 years later, and ran for this seat, the first district of Carolina. He won it surprisingly easily. I think people forgave him for his personal problems, but they still appreciated his fiscal conservatism. However, he has been very anti-Trump in a lot of his rhetoric. He disagreed with Trump on a lot of issues, like the tariffs, and his primary opponent capitalized on that. She made it known that she supported Trump no matter what, and that's what ultimately doomed him. And he ended, even though he had a huge cash advantage over her, I think people grew tired of him and they wanted her. So it's kind of a mixed blessing, I think, because he's had such a long career in politics. It was probably time for him to go anyways. But the fact that he got defeated by somebody who's likely not going to be that great on economic issues is kind of the down part of it.
Now, Trey Gowdy, one of the few members of Congress who actually crafted a national reputation, very well known, decided to retire. What happened in his district?
He was elected in the Tea Party wave of 2010, and I think he grew frustrated in Congress. And naturally, it was an open seat race. In South Carolina, they have runoffs. So there were so many candidates running that the primary was held, and it was obvious that it was the top two finishers were going to go to a runoff.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
More than 245,000 students in the past 15 years have left Los Angeles public schools to get their education in charter schools. Eric Boehm and Lisa Snell are here to explain why. Eric?
The Los Angeles Unified School District, that's the public school district for the city of Los Angeles, has lost 250,000 students in the last 15 years. Now, just to put that in perspective, if you gathered all those students together into a single district, it would be one of the 10 biggest school districts in the United States. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Lisa Snell. She is the director of education for the Reason Foundation. She's a colleague of mine, and she is one of the authors of a new report by the Reason Foundation looking at the financial problems at the Los Angeles Unified School District. And those problems, school district officials like to blame on the fact that students are leaving the schools. They're leaving, of course, to find better alternatives in charter schools or in other districts outside of the city. But that, as the new Reason report reveals, is not really the underlying cause, but rather just a symptom of a series of financial problems with the Los Angeles Unified School District. Lisa, thanks so much for taking some time and being here on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. So the LA school officials, they love to point at charter schools and say, oh, look, those charter schools, they're taking our students, as if the public school system has some sort of right to educate those kids. If the public schools can't do it, it's a good thing that that kids and parents are choosing to go to different schools, to go to charter schools or to leave the district altogether. This new report from the Reason Foundation kind of looks at that claim and debunks it. Tell us a little bit about why these numbers are as dire as they are for the LA Unified School District.
Obviously, high-quality charter schools that get kids into college, that get them to graduate, that improve their scores in reading and math, are all reasons that parents in Los Angeles are flocking to charter schools. But that's certainly not the only thing going on. I mean, LA Unified's actually lost more students to Riverside County because of housing prices and Bakersfield than because of charter schools. They've lost more students because of the nationwide decline in birth rate. And like you said about the 245,000 students being the school district, even with this loss in students, they still have 500,000 students and are the second largest school district in the country. You should have enough money with 500,000 students to be able to not blame families that move because they can't afford housing or choose a higher quality charter school. The other thing is that during this time of declining enrollment, especially in the last 5 years, it's been a huge time of increases in funding for California under the local control funding formula. So they actually have seen their per pupil money go up and up and up. They have more money to spend on less students. That didn't help. Like, they basically have a $500 million structural deficit every year, which means basically they spend about $500 million a year more than revenue that they take in.
So the school district is getting more money. They're actually getting, as you said, Lisa, they're actually getting more per pupil now from the state than they were 10 years ago when they had a bigger district. So they've got fewer students, more per pupil money, and yet the school district continues to have a $500 million deficit, and they're falling further behind this year. Revenues are even further behind expenses. I have to ask, if it's not the fact that the students are leaving, obviously that's not causing this problem because they're actually getting more money now. What is the cause of these problems?
They've had a huge staffing surge. So while they lost 245,000 students, while they lost 55,000 in the last 5 years, they've hired more adults, specifically not teachers, so more administrators, more other kinds of staff. They've staffed up their schools. They had the biggest bond building program, $20 billion in the country. During this time of losing students, they built a whole bunch of new schools. And so they didn't close old public schools. They just opened new schools. And they have 500,000 students. Supposedly they have capacity for about 700,000 students in terms of their seats. So they have too many schools open, and two things are true at once. They have too many staff in the district, and they can't afford them. But then at individual schools, they're actually stretched thin, where principals feel like their schools are not adequately staffed.
We're talking with Lisa Schnell. She is the director of education for the Reason Foundation, and she's one of the authors of a new report that the Reason Foundation has out looking at the problems at Los Angeles Unified School District. You can find that report at reason.org. And I think a lot of the conclusions here and a lot of these problems that you talk about, Lisa, really can be applied to other big urban school districts all over the country. This mentality that we've been talking about, of school officials of saying, well, you know, we can hire more people and build more schools even though we're losing students, that is something that you only ever see in government. It's something that you really see, I think, often in schools in particular, in sort of the education bureaucracy of government. What does the LA Unified School District, what do these other school districts have to do to shift that thinking now that this is a world now where there is more competition and choice when it comes to education than there ever has been before? And that requires changes that I guess aren't happening in LA.
Yeah, it's funny because yesterday LA Unified has released another budget where it's basically the triumph of hope over experience, where they're saying, like, they're counting on the state of California to raise revenue, the next governor, to get more money. And they've done very little to reduce costs again. And this is, like you say, a nationwide problem. They don't face the reality of right-sizing their schools for the number of students.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of those costs, those are long-term things, pensions or the debt for building new schools. That's not stuff you can wipe off the books in a couple of years. But if you don't start trying, if you don't start shifting policy with an eye towards those long-term obligations, then, you're never going to get there. They need to change, and this is obviously not the first warning that they've received. That is unfortunately all the time that we have for today, Lisa. So thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Thank you so much.
That is Lisa Schnell. She is the Director of Education for the Reason Foundation. Check out the Reason Foundation's new report on the LA Unified School District at reason.org. And even if you don't live in LA, as I said earlier, there's really a lot in this report that I think applies to other big urban districts around the country, Philadelphia, Chicago. They're all facing these same kinds of problems of long-term costs and losing students to charter schools and better alternatives because they just can't compete. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check us out at reason.com, and we'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Trump has upended decades of American diplomacy with a unique style all his own. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why it is working.
The North Korea and United States negotiations, as well as the G7-U.S. relationship, have taken center stage in recent days. The style of diplomacy in the first 2 years of the Trump administration signals a total departure from the negotiating style used by the United States since World War II. The departure from the conventional approach has taken many in the world community, and in fact in our nation, by surprise. At the same time, the possibility of solutions coming to fruition in so many difficult areas have finally appeared on the horizon. In the case of North Korea, our nation has been stalemated by this rogue nation since the end of the Korean War. Even during the Korean War, the influence of the Chinese on the peninsula was well documented, as it has been to the current time. Additionally, the threat of nuclear war with North Korea became all too real in recent years. President Trump, however, through a series of unconventional diplomatic and pseudo-psychological operation tactics, brought North Korea to the bargaining table. The success or failure with North Korea of this new approach will not be known for quite some time, but the president's unconventional style has thus far stopped missile testing aimed at Guam and possibly mainland United States. Hawaii experienced efforts of an erroneous air drill on the island, but the error did have the effect of highlighting how apprehensive everyone had become with the rogue North Korean state. In much the same way, the G7 tariff retaliation and summit tensions reflect an entirely different type of diplomacy than previously seen. The last time something was seen like this was when Reagan walked away from the Soviet summit in Reykjavik, Iceland. When diplomacy is viewed from a short-term, immediate gratification perspective, as opposed to the long-term results that are achieved, strategic diplomacy will fail. The difficulties of managing public relations of a diplomatic campaign can never be underestimated. The Vietnam War, as an example, was lost diplomatically rather than militarily. The defeat diplomatically caused the strategic defeat militarily, and then Vietnam was lost. I watched all too frequently when I served in the United States Marine in Iraq, when serving with the multinational force Iraq, that a completely different diplomatic style would be required to restore the United States to a position of world influence, both economically and militarily. The president is breaking the traditional approach to the United States diplomacy in which we negotiated from the soundbite perspective that was misguidedly perceived as a strategy. President Trump is signaling that we will be dealing from a perspective of resolving problems permanently by the solutions enacted and dealing from a position of equality, a worldwide equality as equal partners on the world stage. He is directing that the State Department negotiate using the comparative advantage, dealing with our strength as a nation, as our new arsenal of diplomatic weaponry that we have, to establish parity for American workers and businesses, as well as the United States economy in the world community. The president, for the first time since Reagan, is focusing on appropriate measures of effectiveness, such as the balance of trade to measure parity of our trade agreements. Our nation has historically believed that the balance of trade meant nothing, when in fact the president knows that it is a critical barometer of economic success. Over the past 40 years, our nation's industries have suffered horrifically at the hands of our nation's misguided foreign policy. At the end of World War II, the compassionate response of the Marshall Plan made sense and helped rebuild a devastated Europe, Japan, and China. Once these nations were rebuilt, however, it is imperative that we transition back to the equality of trading partners. Our State Department never made the transition, and as such, the stage was set for undermining of American industry, which put us at great strategic weakness. Trump is negotiating using the position of strength as a consumer and a financial powerhouse that we are to reestablish a level playing field. In the long run, all nations being strong will remove tariffs and allow all nations to compete and thrive through the benefits and advantages of a free market system. The temporary interruptions of the G7 and the tariffs, as well as the potential progress made with North Korea, require patience and consistency in foreign policy. Our international neighbors must know that we are serious. Previously, our threats and actions carried no weight. With President Trump, our trading partners know precisely where he stands, and as such, they know precisely where they stand. With that understanding, our neighbors will have every incentive to negotiate and to resolve our mutual differences. Problems will start to be solved, and economic prosperity and free trade will result. For the American Radio Journal, I am Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMBS AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, KWFM FM in Wichita Falls, Texas, along with WSBP LP in Woodridge, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.